So one of the issues that I've had for a very long time, especially as I've gotten older, is finding a good pair of jeans. When I was young, this wasn't a problem for me, but now that comfort's the number one factor that I look for, I just hadn't found anything that worked as something I could wear all day, every day, until now. Men, if you hate khakis like I do, your time has come. The Perfect Jean was created by a conglomerate of mostly imperfect men and a couple of extra perfect ladies who set out on a mission to find a jean that we can wear no matter what we're doing. Whether you're lounging on the couch, working outside, salsa dancing, doing yoga poses, or dunking a basketball, this is a pair of jeans that is built for your life. I picked up a pair skeptical at first because I'd been let down so many times before, but I've got to tell you, these jeans slip on like your favorite pair of sweatpants. You know the ones. Once I had my pair, I reached out to the team at Perfect Jean and asked them if I could run an ad on my show, and they were kind enough to offer you, yes, you listening right now, a special 25% off discount code that you can use when you pick up your very own pair. Don't be like me and pay full price. Take advantage and pick up the best pair of jeans you've ever worn right now. Head to theperfectjean.nyc and enter the discount code 25FORFRIENDS at checkout to get 25% off your very own pair of Perfect Jeans. Waiting for this one for a long time, sir. Our Strange Skies. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, no. Thank you for having me on, man. Loving the podcast so far. You've had a lot of great guests on.
Yeah, we try. It's pretty. It's a pretty eccentric group of people, but it's been a lot of fun, and I think it's only going to get more fun as we go on. So I'm excited about that. Now, I want to ask you. Like, I have so many questions for you, but I guess we should just sort of give folks a bit of a background on you before we get into the heavy stuff. So tell us about your background.
About 5 years ago, now I essentially had a UFO sighting while I was at work, and it was this really strange experience because I went outside. I was with a coworker of mine. He dragged me outside because. I basically do the laundry for a medium-sized nursing home, so I'm generally doing about, on average, like 500 pounds of laundry a day, which can be daunting with one person by himself, and like I don't really have any help. I just fold everything by hand, and I'm like,
oh my God.
At first, I was like, yeah, he's just like trying to drag me outside. And at first, I'm like, nah, man, I'm behind. But he just wouldn't take no for an answer. So we're outside. We're just standing on the corner of the property of the nursing home, and we were just talking. And all of a sudden, we looked up, and we see this. The best way to describe it is a giant egg. That's what it looked like. Just like an uncracked egg, blown up. Like 1,000 times its size, just floating in the air. And it kind of just, like, was moving parallel to where we were standing. Mm. And when it got to about right where we were, it stopped in the middle of the air, turned 90 degrees, and headed north away from us. And from that moment on, we were both kind of hooked, but the weird thing was, in that moment, we were kind of just, we were dumbfounded by what we saw, but we were also very apathetic to what we were looking at. Like,
yeah,
almost like we had seen it 1,000 times before, but I have never seen anything like it.
Wow.
And you, in those moments, and after, you question yourself, why didn't I do anything different? Why didn't I even move? Why didn't I try to reach for my phone,
right,
or anything like that? And since then, I just started buying books about UFOs. I started to read everything that I could about UFOs, and it led me to the podcasting community.
Yeah.
And it started with Astonishing Legends. I had followed them. It was like maybe 3 years ago now.
Right.
I had started listening to them, and I was just like talking to Scott one day on Twitter, and I think I had mentioned something about the Men in Black or something like that.
Yeah.
And he messages me and he goes, hey, do you want to be in the Astonishing Research Corps? I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? I don't have anything else better to do. But after that, I started networking with all these podcasters, started making friendships within the community, and I started throwing out UFO cases that I thought that paranormal podcasters should be looking into.
Yeah.
There are a lot of interesting ones that don't often get highlighted. So a few of them took me up on it and covered some of the stories until I just finally said, I could do this. I mean, I could be a podcaster. My dad was in radio for 20 years.
Yeah.
I had a radio show when I was 13 years old. It was
awesome.
Nothing special, but
yeah,
I had the bug back then, but from all of that, I started the Our Strange Skies podcast in late 2017, December 2017. Our first episode went up, and
yeah,
since then, it's like just immersing yourself in this weird world where it's UFOs nonstop. There's some aliens and weird stuff like that, and some crazy government sounding people that want to shake you down for talking about your UFOs.
Yeah. And we're going to get into all that. I'm actually going to take you full circle and throw out some names a little later, some cases, and see what you think about them. As you're talking about that, do you ever go back and think about that night? I mean, you mentioned earlier that you didn't want to go out, you know, you don't want to go outside, you were busy. Do you ever think that was sort of fate for you to go out there and witness what you witnessed that night?
For me, yeah. I mean, I always felt like I was supposed to see that.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. It wasn't my first UFO sighting. I had a UFO sighting when I was a teenager. I was like 14 or 15 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And this was like shortly after my sister had moved out of her house, and I had moved into her bedroom, and we'd placed my bed right by the window. And there was this one night, I think it was like maybe February or March. I remember it being cold outside, but it's like 9 o'clock, 9:30 at night. I'm getting ready for bed, and I just looked out the window. And it's always those weird feelings of, hey, look out the window. Why not?
Yeah.
And I see this orange light, and I didn't really think anything of it at first. And then it blinked off. And then it blinked on again, but it was in a different position. And it kept doing this over and over again. Like, it kept making this side-to-side motion where it would turn on, turn off, to the point where I just lost interest in it, which is a very weird thing. I still don't know how to grapple with that. But I just remember losing interest, going to bed, and kind of forgetting about it for a while.
Interesting. Now, and that takes us sort of to the podcast, Our Strange Skies. That's such a great name. Let's talk about the name. How did you come up with the name? How did that show come to be, as far as just, you know, kind of naming it and kind of putting it out there?
I had a Twitter account since like 2011, and I was just like throwing ideas around and stuff like that. And then I was getting to the naming portion, and like I kind of had a democratic way of going about it, and I'm like, I threw out four names. I can't remember the other three, but I know they weren't very good.
Yeah.
But Our Strange Skies was one of them, and it's just like, you know, I think this is the one. Let's see how, you know, people react to it and stuff. So I started throwing out these names, and one of them was a Twitter poll, and Our Strange Skies won out there. I did it on my Instagram account. One out there, and I'm like, okay, I think we really got something here. But the cool thing was is that Scott Thrower from the Fairy Tales for Unwanted Children podcast.
Oh yeah, sure.
He had written in, I think, on my Instagram post, and he had said, you know, I always wanted to hear a UFO podcast that was called In Gray We Trust. And I'm like, oh man, that That is like, that'd be an interesting name for a podcast, but I'm like, that would be a great tagline. I was like, thanks for the tagline, Scott.
Yeah, for real. Yeah. And that's on some of your merch and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. A shout out to Scott. That's a great tagline. Yeah. So we're learning some inside stuff here. Now I wanted to ask you like about this, and every time I have a podcaster on the show, I ask him about the structure of the show a little bit. Cause I think it's important because we tend to, this particular show tends to skew a little bit younger in the audience. And we tend to have a lot of people that want to do, you know, what you're doing. They want to start a show of their own. They have a passion like you have about something else, or even about this topic we're going to talk about tonight. And they want to do it. So I want to get into the structure of the show a little bit. Can you tell us sort of what the concept of the show is and how you approach that work that you're doing?
For the longest time, I didn't really know what I wanted to do in terms of the podcast. I was kind of meandering between, research topics, like really diving deep into stuff and like interviews. And really what happened was I was listening to what listeners were really engaging with. I was looking at like our most downloaded episodes and stuff. So last year I went into this focus of the really well-researched episodes, but there was nobody really doing kind of what I was doing. Like there are other paranormal podcasts out there like mine that do very narrative driven stuff, and there was really nobody doing that on the UFO side devoted solely to UFOs. So I'm like, I can fill that void. I have a knack for this kind of research. So I shifted my podcast to research heavy, very written out, really extensively written out scripts, and I infused music into it. It was kind of all of an organic thing because I was figuring it out on the fly. And one of the things that you really need to do if you really wanted to get into podcasting and figuring out what works for you is listen to a whole gaggle of podcasts.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like the Stephen King advice that if you don't read, you don't have the tools to write. It's the same for podcasting.
That's a great line.
So, yeah, and that I just immersed myself in podcasts, and one podcast that I really attached to, and it's one of my all-time favorite podcasts, is The Conspirators. Mm. And it's just really great storytelling. Nate does a fantastic job in his podcast. And he's able to tell a really intricate narrative. He's really well researched, and that was like the podcast I was trying to emulate. And I don't think I am anywhere in his neck of the woods, but I'm confident in what I do now, which is weird because it took so long to get there.
Yeah.
So long to get there, but it was just in June of last year. Like for me in the podcasting, it's been tough because I started out, you know, really strong, and then my mom died, and after that, I just kind of lost the will to do it.
Yeah.
I lost the drive to do it, and then in June, I just kind of got angry. My sister lost her brother-in-law to cancer, and I'm like, ugh.
Yeah.
Like, I need to do something. So I kind of just came back from this hiatus that I put myself on, and I'm like, this is going to be my focus. So the first episode we did out of the gate, it was an episode about this really interesting French UFO flap that led to this really strange law in this town that basically forbid UFOs to fly over it. So from there, you know, we've done like 20 or so episodes, and it's been great to find this niche.
Yeah.
This way of presenting it. And the only thing that's terrible about it is like, if I try to do this thing weekly, I just burn myself out.
Right.
So I'm getting to the point where I have to understand that I can't do this weekly, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But It's taken a long time to get there.
Yeah, I mean the line "Know your limits," it comes to mind. I mean, I've been there as well, doing the their hard thing and wrapping that up. And there were times where I just didn't want to do it anymore. I didn't have the drive to do it. But you know, for me, it was my, you know, I had a 8 and 9 year old at the time. Now he's 10, but watching what I'm doing, and I wanted to be able to tell him, like, look, you know, when you start something, you finish it, regardless on if you slug or crawl to the finish line. As long as you cross that finish line, it doesn't matter what condition you're in, as long as you cross it and you finish it, that's the most important thing. And so that's, you know, and you know, you're talking about finding that niche, which I think is a really great question to kind of follow up on. This is this topic, UFOs, the paranormal, anything just in that genre. It's obviously a very flooded genre. It's a very flooded market for podcasting. How important is it for you to find that niche for a podcast in your particular genre? Because there's so much out there. But how do you find that niche? Like, do you have to actively sort of work on that as you're kind of developing the show?
Yeah, you really do. You have to. One thing that you notice is that when a big name podcast covers a topic, and this isn't a dig on really any other podcasts, a bunch of podcasts after that will cover that topic.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think the biggest example of that in the last year and a half is the BetSphere. After Astonishing Legends covered it, everybody covered it.
Yeah.
To the point of like super saturation almost. Like, I've heard
Yeah.
this story so many times, and it's like it was one of those ones that was on the periphery. So you do kind of have to find your niche, and the nice thing about UFOs is that it has such a rich and intricate history, and there are so many accounts out there that you can cover this topic for an endless amount of episodes, and somebody will come away with something they have never heard before.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to do more than anything. I will always cover the stories that people know by heart. I'll always cover things like Betty and Barney Hill,
Sure.
the Lonnie Zamora incidents, stuff like that. But it's always those really strange cases in these obscure like issues of what we have is a flying saucer review. And the great thing is like it's a now defunct magazine that was devoted to flying saucers, you know, UFO accounts, abduction reports,
Yeah.
stuff like that. And they're all digitized on the web. So all you really need to do is open up an issue and you will find so much stuff. And a portion of that, one of the last cases that I covered, the Avalee abduction, came from this really extensive report in a 2 issues of Flying Saucer Review. So,
Yeah.
for UFOs, I would say more than probably any paranormal subject, it's got a richer history.
Yeah.
The only thing that gets to you at a certain after a certain point is that all you're doing is covering UFOs, and you kind of back yourself into this where like, yeah, you found your niche, but like, you're also kind of stuck with it. So
Yeah.
you either, you know, you might try to do something different every now and then. Like for Halloween, I did a bunch of different stuff. I covered a lot of stories from my neck of the woods. I
You were Ichabod Crane.
had these. Yeah, I was. I played Ichabod Crane,
Right. Bet you never thought
which
that
was
was going to
super
happen.
fun. No, I didn't see that coming. But it was super fun to do. Anytime anyone wants me to do any kind of voiceover work,
Yeah.
it's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. I'm not a professional, but I love to do
It's a
it.
lot of fun. Yeah, it is a lot of fun.
It
And you were
is.
spectacular. For all those people that are listening to that, like, what the hell are they talking about? There'll be a link in the show notes. You can listen to Rob as Ichabod Crane. It's pretty great. You know, it's funny, as you're talking about that, I know you touched on sort of some of the experiences you've had personally, but you know, every time I talk with someone that's neck deep in something, I mean, every time, you know, the passion or the obsession, depending on who you're talking to, has always, it's always been with them. It marinates when they're a kid. So I wanted to ask you, and I know you touched on a little bit, but when you were young, when you were like really young, do you remember having this like attraction to the unexplained when you were a kid?
It was always there because at the time that I was growing up, Ghostbusters was huge.
Oh yeah.
I I was born in 83, and throughout most of the 80s, it was there. I mean, Ghostbusters 2 came out in like 1990, so it was there. We had the real Ghostbusters cartoon series, which was
Yeah.
like one of my all-time
I had the
favorites.
lunch pail.
Yeah, I did
Yeah, with a thermos and everything. I had all that, dude. I
Yep.
thought I was legit going to school with that.
Hell yeah, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I definitely did. And but a lot of the programs that I remember from my childhood like had ghosts and stuff in it. There was before there was the real Ghostbusters, there was this really weird cartoon series co just called Ghostbusters. And
Yeah.
it's yeah, with that purple
Yep.
monkey and that really weird car. Yeah,
Oh
I
yeah.
remember watching that, and like ghosts and stuff were always kind of there.
Yeah.
And the UFO stuff started to take hold when I was about 8 or 9, and our family would watch Unsolved Mysteries together.
Yeah.
And Robert Stack is just the most haunting looking human I have ever seen.
Yeah, great voice too, of course, legendary.
Great voice. The man had a presence, and it's incredible to watch on screen, because it's just like, is the man ever not
Yeah,
serious?
for real, yeah. Imagine being married to him, you know?
It's just straight up like, if he talks like that in real life, I don't know
Right.
how if I'd been able to handle that. But there were cases on that, UFO cases, that I still think about every day or every week. And we covered Lonnie Zamora. That is one that I remember watching many times in my childhood, whether it was on reruns or whatever.
Yeah.
And that one just, I don't know, it just stuck in my head. There was also this really bizarre abduction case with these four guys that were in a canoe on a on this remote lake in Maine, and they were abducted out of it, and the aliens that they drew just gave me nightmares.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
but I don't know. It's like you can't really escape it, and once it's there, for a long time in our family, it wasn't necessarily a taboo thing, but it was like something you brought up occasionally. It wasn't something you talked about all the time, but it was something that we shared with each other. It was like, oh yeah, I think I had, this kind of ghostly experience or whatever. And it was always there in the family. There was always that kind of stuff when I was a kid.
It's it, this is going to turn into a Ghostbusters tangent, but I remember watching obviously Ghostbusters when I was a kid, and I just recently my showed it to my son well probably about a year ago now, and just watching it's when you have kids and especially like watching him watch Ghostbusters for the I almost wasn't watching the screen. I was just watching him watch it. And when Stay Puft comes on the screen and just all these it's like watching Ghostbusters for the first time again. And then I showed him the new trailer, which I think is one of the best trailers I've ever seen in my life, because I've always been a fan of a trailer, kind of whetting your appetite but not giving away the story too much. And he just his eye, especially now that they're it's more of it's kids in the new trailer, like the whole Stranger Things vibe, like he cannot he's asking me almost every day, like, when's the movie coming out? I can't wait to go see it. So I get to sort of experience his Ghostbusters sort of phenomenon, like almost all over again, like when I was a kid. And even playing the video game, like the PS2 or the PS3 video game, when that dropped out, and him and I were playing it together. And yeah, Ghostbusters is, I think you can trace that people that are fans of that stuff to that movie, and to that, what they did. And it's pretty remarkable. It's like a major, major deal.
It was, and like, I think what is unique about Ghostbusters is not just like the world building, but like Dan Aykroyd was all about the tech in that, and that was so great. It's just
Yeah.
so fantastic.
Yeah, I love it. I love all that aspect of it. What did you think of the trailer of the new trailer?
I love the trailer. I honestly can't wait to see what this movie is going to be, because you kind of have a tone, but you don't really have too much of what's going on, which is great, which I can get behind, because
Yeah.
I've seen those trailers before that just give away so much, and it just kind of ruins a film for you. But like,
Yeah.
I'm super excited for it.
Yeah, I told my wife, I was like, all right, I'm sold. I don't need to see another trailer. I don't want to see another trailer, because ultimately they're going to come out with a second trailer, because I think, isn't it coming out this summer? So they're going to come out with something pretty quick probably. So I mean, I almost don't want to see it. I just want to go in with what I've seen, no spoilers. I'm just super excited to see that movie. It's a big deal for me. So what I wanted to do, what I want to talk to you about, and I've always been fascinated about sort of what you do, and it really does come through in the show. So it really, it's a testament to what you do and kind of how the show is structured and how it comes together. But I want to ask you about tracking down viable information, because as you know more than anybody, there's so much out there when it comes to UFOs. There's almost as much bogus information as there is real, honest, sort of quantifiable information. And we'll get to some of the more current cases, one in particular I want to get your opinion on. But how do you separate sort of the legitimate from the fake when it comes to that researching information, or just stuff that just doesn't belong? There's obviously different categories, but how do you separate all that?
There's usually a jumping off point when it comes to the information that you're looking for. So, when it comes to the base account of something, if you can find it in multiple sources retold the same way over and over again, you can generally garner that that information is reliable. It's usually after a certain point where it gets a little shaky. For instance, there's an abduction case. It's called the Pascagoula abduction. These two fishermen standing on a pier in Pascagoula, Mississippi, were abducted by these really strange-looking beings that had this really wrinkly gray skin. They had these appendages on their face, one where the nose would be, and two, one on either side where the ears would be. And the consistency in their stories up front are really that there is no faltering them. They told a consistent story throughout the years. It's usually after that where you get into the areas of, well, we had repeat contact over the years. They came back and they came. And that's where you start to stand a little more on shaky ground. So in those situations, you kind of have to take it with a grain of salt. But for me, if it adds to the story, I don't necessarily mind as much. And I haven't covered a lot of stories that are like that. I think one of the ones that probably the most difficult one that I've covered on the show is the abduction of Terry Lovelace. And you know, it's a story that Scott and Forrest covered over at Astonishing Legends. It's one that they were asking me about a few times, like, what do you think of Terry Lovelace? What do you think of Terry Lovelace? And I think Terry's an honest guy. I think he's telling the truth. There's just things about his account that are kind of like a little iffy for me. He hides some details there that should be verifiable and stuff, and there are some aspects of his story that are tougher to believe. But at the end of the day, I don't necessarily think it's pertinent to believe people. I think it's important to listen to people and listen to these stories and see how they affect you. And I think that's the most important thing, and what I try to do most is to tell these stories with as much detail as possible, because the details to me are the most important thing. And one of the things that I always try to do with every story is just look for every nitty-gritty detail that maybe somebody hasn't heard before, or has been lost to time or something like that. And you know, we've found a lot of interesting information just in, you know, the last year. I have one researcher that works with me consistently. His name is Rory, and in 2018, I turned to him and I said, all right, what am you know, th this goes back to Lonnie Zamora again. I'm like, I want to cover this case, but I want to cover it in depth as much as possible. I was like, you have a year, see what you can come up with. And he found some startling information that could point to a government program that Lonnie Zamora just happened to stumble into. So
wow,
it's those kind of like details and in the digging that I always try to focus on when I do these stories. Like the narrative is always going to be there, but it's what else you can find there that I really love and that I really just gravitate to once I start doing the research.
Yeah, and I guess that leads to a good question too, is what are the reactions like when you're researching these cases? I mean, are the people you reach out to generally skeptical? Does it lean more towards most people believing? I mean, what is that general consensus there?
I think it's almost kind of split in the middle. Like you talk to some people, like, to me, if you want to look at the scale of things, firmly on the skeptical side, I'd put somebody like Chris Cogswell, one of my good buddies of the Mad Scientist podcast.
Oh, yeah, I love Chris.
It takes a lot to convince Chris. He's open to things, but it takes a lot of, you know, evidence, quote-unquote evidence, and that's the really tough thing to nail down in a UFO case. What counts as evidence? What is evidence? We don't really know, because a lot of the physical evidence, while it may stand out as very odd, and most of the time it usually has to do with, like, burnt vegetation and mostly like minor changes to the environment, but when it's kind of major, it makes you, you know, perk your ears and say, oh, well, that's kind of unusual. But you get the whole gamut from your Chris Cogswells to I've talked to many people who are just believers in everything. Mm-hmm. And I think it was like Jim Harold who said it's important to have an open mind, but not too open so your brain falls out.
Yeah, that's another great quote.
Yeah, so like the nice thing is like it always generally leads to great conversation. Yeah. Regardless. And like I've gotten some great cases from, you know, either side of it. So I think it's kind of an even split most of the time.
Yeah, it's funny. There was a Gallup poll done, I want to say in June of 2019, so not that long ago. And yep. You know, the question is very simple. And we'll get that kind of leads to my next question here in a minute here. But the question that they asked was, in your opinion, does the U.S. government know more about UFOs than it's telling us? And I think I want to say like 68 or 70% of the people believe that that's the case. That you know, that the U.S. government actually knows more than what they've let on, and so that's a pretty big number. I mean, 70% essentially of all people that they polled say yes, there is something more here than just there's nothing in the universe besides Earth. That's it. So that's pretty remarkable. I thought
it is, and I think a lot of people have, especially in the times that we live in now, a general distrust of their government, which you know is expected, but. That's always been there with UFOs, and it's kind of interesting to see how the shift from the kind of early days of ufology, which goes back to 1947, the government kind of was there to begin with. They started researching the topic in late 47. They did it kind of quietly under the table with the FBI for a little bit, until the FBI didn't like what the government was doing and finally just said, eh, we're done. Until about 1948, when you start to get into the, you know, well-known government projects like Project Sign, Project Grudge. The most famous is, of course, Project Blue Book.
Sure.
And from there, the level of distrust in the government, it always boils down to what the nature of the cover-up is, because the government is hiding information. It's just we don't really know what the nature of that information is.
Right.
So we're kind of, a lot of people are kind of just assuming that the government knows that there are aliens out there. They may be working with aliens. Like, there are all these wild theories. There's one wild theory that says that Dwight D. Eisenhower signed a treaty with the Greys, exchanging technology for alien abductions. It's really far-fetched. The thing is, that that cover up kind of nature back then always seemed to be about keeping the public calm, like trying to tamper down mass hysteria and stuff.
Yeah.
In the 1970s, the nature of that cover up changed to, well, the government has aliens and they're hiding it from us.
Right.
And that's kind of the mentality that has persisted to now, and it's been perpetrated by people like Bob Lazar, the guy who claimed to work at S4, worked on UFOs, back engineering UFOs. The interesting thing is like he only worked on that project for, I want to say it was only for like a few weeks before he was allegedly, you know, kicked off of it. But his story is interesting. Even, you know, I don't totally believe it, but it's an interesting story nonetheless. But that nature of this cover up, that the government has alien technology, they're hiding it from us, and all that has been like this one theory that has been perpetuated since then. It's been like a really strange like explosion from the 50s to now.
Well, yeah, and there's some cases that we'll definitely get into. I want to ask you about that have sort of shifted the conversation a little bit as far as, you know, some potential evidence of UFOs finally sort of coming to light and some sources that are hard to sort of dispute or stand up against. But I guess the first question before we kind of get into that is, hypothetically, what do you think might be revealed to the public if all of a sudden everything our government had on this subject was just made public?
I think you would see documentation that shows that they studied a bunch of cases that came across their desk. They may have even studied certain incidents in the field as they were taking place, but I think a lot of people are looking for this revelation that is not going to be coming from the government, that this is essentially extraterrestrial technology or something like that. And a lot of the true believers and a lot of people in the UFO community kind of latch on to that. It's their bread and butter. It's what the government has to be holding. I think it would be a lot tamer. The government would probably bring a lot of interesting cases to the table that we don't know about necessarily, because there will be cases that involve military personnel, most likely pilots and stuff. And
yeah,
I mean, some pilots have come forward. They've told their stories. The David Fravor story that was told in the New York Times, for instance.
Yeah. We'll get into that for sure. That's the one I want to talk to you about. Yeah. And actually, there's another thing I want to sort of ask you about, and I want to sort of set the stage for, you know, the next question here. And then I promise there's a question at the end of this, but, so like in December, I'll obviously correct me if I'm wrong too with any of this, but in December of 17, a couple of videos emerged that show Navy pilots encountering mysterious sort of spherical objects that appear sort of at first glance to move through the air in ways that sort of, you know, baffle all the experts really. And a third clip is released, I think in February or March of 18, shows a similar kind of encounter. Everyone who watches, and even the pilots who film them, they sort of are asking like, what the hell are these things? You know, it's even the pilots are kind of baffled by it. This past September, a Navy official sort of publicly calls all these mysterious objects unidentified aerial phenomena. So now we have UAP now, instead of UFO, you have UAP, and sort of, you know, giving kind of that name to those. Of course, the Navy doesn't want to use that term UFO, even though the objects that are flying, they can't be identified. It's kind of the definition of a UFO. Here, let me give you the quote. The quote is, the Navy designates the objects contained in these videos as unidentified aerial phenomena. And then the quote goes on to say, the unidentified aerial phenomena terminology is used because it provides the basic descriptor for the sighting / observations of unauthorized / unidentified aircraft / objects that have been observed entering / operating in the airspace of various military controlled training ranges, end quote. So my question at the end of all that for you is, are we starting to see a shift in sort of what the U.S. government's willing to admit about these incidents, considering sort of who is now coming forward with claims and even really sort of unexplainable evidence now?
I think a little bit. Yeah, I think the especially with what was revealed in the New York Times with those pilots, and then there was a follow-up story last year in the Times by the same writers of the original story.
Yeah,
with additional pilots talking about their sightings off of, I think they were off the coast of Virginia or something like that, and I they're very credible sources, so. I think these are the teasers. I don't know if we're going to get anything more from the government, to be completely honest, because we had I believe it was the Navy saying that they were going to change their standards for reporting UFOs.
Sure.
And then about a week or two later, they came forward and said, well, we're not going to release that information to the public. So
yeah,
it's going to be... probably retired pilots, retired military personnel that will be coming forward with their stories on the government end. I think the one thing that gets a little lost in all of the latest rounds of like the UFOs being in the mainstream is just the average Joe, the average witness.
Yeah.
And that's something that I always take umbrage with, and it's one thing that I've clashed with the UFO community over, is what stories are getting reported, what stories are like leading the pack in a way. And I like where I'm at with my podcast, because I can focus on the stories that aren't necessarily military pilots, not to say that I don't, you know, cover them from time to time, but I think the individual witness, regardless of whether they have a military background, regardless of whether they are a trained observer, has something to bring to the table with whatever incident that they're, whatever thing that they're seeing, whatever strange object comes by their sight. Any information really is valuable if you know how to ask the right questions.
You know, that, and that begs the point or the question, and that's a great point you're making. Do you think though that, do you think that some of these, and I'm just going to say, I'm going to use the term loosely, I mean, not that they're not, but you know, these credible sources or some of these sources that are from a standpoint of just a certain position that someone might hold in the military, the government or something, coming out and saying, hey, this is what we saw, or this is an incident that we can't explain. Do you think that helps sort of provide a sense of vindication for some of the folks that have come out that are just the average person that had experiences themselves? Do you think that sort of helps propel some of that, or does that ultimately discredit or hurt some of that?
I think it helps more than it hurts. Mm-hmm. Before this, a lot of the military witnesses that came forward did so to UFO researchers in books. They there was, you know, have been disclosure panels and stuff that they have done with the government. Like there's been like a mock hearing done.
Yeah,
that didn't really do anything. But they are. It's not to say that military witnesses aren't important, but they will probably bring the most amount of credibility to the UFO topic, and they have. There's a lot of talk around the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences. They have been kind of the front runners in all of this, in that they've helped bring the New York Times stories into a wider audience. They have a show on the History Channel. Mm-hmm. They are putting out books on the topic. They're covering the subject from their angle. Yeah. So it's got more eyes on it than it ever has.
Yeah. You think that helps?
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Now, I mean, and you mentioned the name earlier, and this is the one I really want to ask you about to talk about a little more extensively, but Commander David Fravor. So like I heard, like a lot of people in general public, because I'm not sort of neck deep in this, but I did hear for the first time David Fravor's story on Joe Rogan's show. And I'm a big Joe Rogan fan. I mean, I love the way he interviews people. I love the conversation. So I got a chance to really sort of listen to that that interview, that testimony, when I heard his story, I think that actually that one story sort of shifted my opinion significantly, because I feel like this is a guy that just simply wouldn't, I look into his eyes and I just feel like he just wouldn't lie about it. Like, I feel like there's no reason for him to lie. But for those who don't know Commander Fravor, he's a retired U.S. Navy pilot. He had a close encounter in 04 with what's being referenced is it the Tic Tac UFO? The Tic Tac UFO, right?
Yep.
What do you make of that story? Let's talk about that a little more in depth.
What's interesting about the Fravor sighting, and essentially what happened to David Fravor, is he was doing some, exercises with a new plane that he was flying. He had a co-pilot with him and such, and another plane with him. And he was out off the coast of San Diego, like a couple hundred miles off the coast of San Diego, and he gets this radio transmission from a nearby ship that says, hey, can you head to this vector and check this thing out? We've got something on our radar. So
yeah.
David Fravor, you know, flies his plane over there, and above the water, he can see what he describes as a 40-foot-long tic-tac. So, like... yeah, it looks just exactly like one, you know, just blown up in size. And, like, he can also see something underneath the water that this thing is hovering over, but he isn't too sure what it is. So he dives down and engages with it. And the thing is, like, it just breaks off. It flies away really quick. It outmaneuvers his plane every chance that it gets. I do believe it flew over his, like, cabin at one point. But
wow.
at a certain point, this object disappeared. And they asked David Fravor and the other pilot to actually go to this other position on the water, and that UFO beat them there.
Yeah.
With seemingly, you know, which raises a lot of question, how would it even know to go there? So
right.
Obviously it has to be monitoring radio transmissions and all that stuff. So the interesting thing about Fravor's sighting is that his story was not broken in the New York Times. Well, at least, you know, that's where it got the widest amount of traction. His story was on the internet on this webpage page called fightersweep.com.
Yeah.
And this guy, Paco Chiarici, he wrote this post in, I believe it was March of 2015, and it's called There I Was, the X-Files Edition. And it's Fravor's story, you know, to a T. In fact, there's more detail in it because there's a lot of, like, military lingo and stuff in that. So we know that his story is reliable, and I think it's one of the most credible UFO accounts of the last 30 years.
Agreed.
Like, it's probably one of the most important in that it's engaging with military pilots, which is it is significant.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about a technology that was able to outmaneuver our own, which is a scary thought. Regardless, and I can only imagine the hysteria back in the 50s when pilots were engaging with these objects and they were outmaneuvered every single time. I mean, one of the earliest examples of that in 1948 was it's known as the Gorman dogfight, and this National Guard pilot just returning home, he's waiting to land, and as he's waiting to land because there's another plane coming in, he sees this really strange ball of light. It's about 6 to 8 inches, and I believe it was just white. And this thing, he sees it, and the moment he decides to engage with it, it turns around, comes right at his plane, and they do this, like, dogfight in the air. And at a certain point, this thing crosses over his canopy, but it's able to outmaneuver him at every step. And that is the story that is told time and time again, that these objects can outmaneuver our own technology. So
yeah,
it's frightening in that.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, that one shifted me, man. And then another one that I was ignorant to, and I hadn't actually heard about, and it's one of the biggest ones, and you touched on it earlier, but is the Betty and Barney Hill case. You just covered it. This is another story, man. It just doesn't feel like it would be untrue. Like if I just, I, you just get that vibe from the story, especially the way you're telling it and the way you're talking about it. For those that may not, you know, have never heard that story, can you give us a little exposition on that one?
Betty and Barney Hill, they were an interracial couple that lived in southern New Hampshire, and they had taken a trip to Niagara Falls and to Montreal just to get away. They had gotten married the year before. They hadn't been able to take a honeymoon, so they just did this impromptu trip. And on their way home, they essentially see this light in the sky that's flying right underneath the moon. It follows their car for about 50 miles until it keeps descending each time. It keeps getting closer until it actually cuts them off on the road. Barney's the one who was driving. He stops the car. He gets out of the car, takes a pair of binoculars as this UFO moves into an open clearing, and he takes them. He looks up at this thing, and he can see windows on the front of this thing, and he can see about 8 people in the windows staring at him. Some are actually just doing things on the ship, but there's one that is staring at him, just it keeps staring at him. And he claims to have telepathic communication with this thing. It's telling him to continue to keep looking and keep looking. And Barney is kind of rooted to the spot. He's so fearful that he can't even move. He has to rip the binoculars away from his face, runs back to the car, and they, you know, tear out of there as quickly as they can. And they hear these sets of beeps a few miles down the road. And after that, they kind of lose consciousness. They're in a bit of a fog, and it's miles later down the road, something like 20 miles later, that they finally come out of it. And about 3 hours of time had passed. They didn't know what had happened to them, and they were actually late returning home from their trip. They should have arrived somewhere around 2:30 in the morning, somewhere around there, and they ended up getting home at about 5:30. So shortly after that, they started to investigate this incident. They found that they were really troubled by the missing time. Betty had dreams. Barney had these anxieties that would pop up at certain times. There was he developed an anxiety of large open fields when he was driving home from work, because he worked at an annex in Boston as a postal worker.
Yeah.
And it eventually led them to a hypnotist named Dr. Benjamin Simon. He did many sessions with them, and what he uncovered was this narrative of alien abduction, which was at the time the first widely publicized abduction account. It kind of made waves in 65 when it was published in a paper called The Boston Traveler.
Yeah.
And the writer of that article basically, without the Hills' permission, put out these articles with a lot of misinformation, which finally led the Hills to write a book about it. But what they found is that their car was kind of led to this deserted road. Like, Barney had made these really weird turns off of the main road, and eventually he drove and stopped in front of a party of really strange-looking humanoids. They dragged them from the car, brought them on board, and they were subjected to medical tests. Betty had a little bit of a better time than Barney did. She was kind of given a little bit of a tour. She was shown a star map from where the beings came from, and they were ultimately returned to their car, and it has become one of the most well-known abduction accounts. In fact, if you ask the average Joe, that's probably the one account that people will name.
Yeah, that and we'll definitely have the link to your episodes on Betty and Barney Hill in the show notes too, because it's really well done. And as I'm listening to you sort of narrate and tell that story, I had never heard of that for whatever reason. It eluded me. I had heard obviously some other ones that we've talked about tonight, but not that one. So I was all in on that one. And I encourage you to listen to it for sure.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah, that was in every single like episode that I try to do, I try to find the human narrative in any and everything. And like, I was fortunate in the source material for those episodes because they were just full of these really human looks at Betty and Barney Hill. They weren't these really dry moment to moment kind of expositions and stuff. So
I
was really fortunate for the source material for those. And those are two of my favorite episodes that we've ever done.
Yeah, definitely great stuff. Now, I mean, as we sort of kind of wind down and wrap up tonight, I did want to do a couple of little things with you. One of the things we do on this show, and if you've heard the show, you might know, we do some word association, and it's a lot of fun because we have different guests in the show and people always say, oh, okay, this is what I want you to ask this person or whatever, word associate with this person. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw out some, some famous incidents, some stuff that we haven't talked about or touched on tonight. And I just want you to give me sort of your first thoughts on it. It doesn't have to be long, just a few words or even a sentence or whatever on it. And we'll go down this list. So the first one is sort of where it all started for a lot of people, or where people, perhaps maybe the most famous case of all time, or at least one of them, it might be arguable, but the Roswell incident.
I don't think we'll ever really know what happened with the Roswell incident. It's an interesting story that I think has been kind of warped here and there, but I think there's something there underneath it that is true. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah. Agreed. I agree with you on that one. Now, this next one is my personal favorite of all time, and it's what sort of got me into it. I think it sort of helped usher in a lot of just UFOs and pop culture, and that's the Travis Walton incident and Fire in the Sky. What do you think about that particular one?
I think it's one of the most credible cases that we have. In the fact that his coworkers saw him get hit with a blue beam of light, which pretty much every single one of them passed the polygraph exam. They haven't changed their story.
Yeah.
Travis's story is interesting beyond that, and I think there is value to it. He hasn't wavered on his story, and I think it's one of the most credible abduction accounts in the annals of UFO lore.
Yeah, and that goes back to what you talked about earlier, is about not changing the story and everything sort of staying consistent over the years is a good way to indicate that there's probably some truth at the center of that. So the lights above the New Jersey Turnpike, that's a really kind of weird one.
It's interesting. Yeah, I don't really know totally. That could be easily explainable, you know.
Yeah.
When you're talking about lights in the sky, they're one of the like most commonly reported phenomena, but anything's possible with that. I'm not totally ruling it out.
and anybody who's ever listened to Chasing Your Heart or the first season of Vanished is knows the name Admiral Chester Nimitz. That's a very, very famous admiral. A whole fleet is named after the man, so I mean he's very legit. And there was an encounter on the USS Nimitz. So what do you think about that particular story?
I think it's very credible. I think it's again, it goes to the really credible military personnel that have encounters. And there are some interesting ships in the Navy fleet that have had encounters with UFOs. There have been two ships, I believe, that were known as the Franklin Delano Roosevelt that had encounters with UFOs. Two different ships. One was decommissioned, the other one is newer, but they both had encounters with UFOs. So I tend to believe when they come from military sources, generally straight up, unless they're really out there. There's a really weird case from Fort Dix in which apparently Army personnel killed an alien that wandered onto their base.
Wow, that's it. Yeah, it just gets stranger and stranger. How about the Chicago O'Hare airport sighting?
there were way too many witnesses for that not to have occurred. And I know somebody back in the day had recorded like footage of whatever this craft was. There were pilots that saw it. So definitely one of the most credible cases of the last 30 years.
Yeah. And I guess that takes me to another one I thought was interesting is the Stephenville sightings.
Yeah. Again, very credible. Like practically the entire town saw these lights over Stephenville.
And from one town to another, the Phoenix Lights.
I ride the fence on the Phoenix Lights because I think a lot of the details are a little confused, because if you look at some of the footage that was shot, they look like military flares. Mm. But in other ones, they don't. And there are people who claim to have seen like the actual boomerang shaped craft, and others that said that they were military planes. I don't think it was military, but then again, I'm not exactly sure. But I think it's one of the more interesting cases in that I don't think we have it pinned down, and I think that's why people are still talking about it.
And speaking of, we talked about earlier on when you first started talking about your experiences about, you know, not grabbing a phone or, you know, not taking a photo, the McMinnville UFO photographs. That's another one I hadn't seen or hadn't, I was ignorant to, and that's, that what took place like in the 50s, right? So it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
You look at that image now and it's how do you, I can't explain how that wouldn't be anything other than something we don't, you know, something other than a UFO. I mean, what do you think about that photograph and that incident and just in general?
I think it's still like people are still talking about it, and I think it's still a pretty credible account. I don't think he's trying to hoax anybody. Mm-hmm. And those photos are really interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was anything. I don't think he was hoaxing anybody.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. And the gentleman who took it, Paul Trent, they printed those in Life magazine. And it's like, it goes back to what you're talking about in the beginning of this conversation, is him and his wife, they had maintained that they were genuine until they died. I mean, so like it was, they never changed their story, that it was always steadfast, that we were always telling the same story every time. And that, you know, that's really amazing. I think it's like, you know, it's really easy to sort of like add to the story and kind of, you know, make it a little more fancy than it was. But if they're just telling the same story every day, essentially, that's pretty remarkable. I think that really gives you a lot of a lot more credibility, I think, than not doing that.
I think the hallmarks of a good witness are those that continue to tell their story, that it doesn't waver, and that they're continuously baffled by what they encountered. I think those are the real good hallmarks of a witness to a UFO.
Yeah. One of my favorite interviewers ever was a gentleman by the name of James Lipton, who he hosted inside mm-hmm. the Actors Studio for many, many years. He recently passed away. I loved his interviews. They're so raw. They're so intimate. I love the setting. I love how it worked. But my favorite part, very interview, of course, is the questionnaire that he gives each guest that sits on stage with him. And so as a tribute to Mr. Lipton, and we're probably going to do this going forward because I think it's just so fun. It's such a fun questionnaire. We're going to continue that starting with tonight with you, if you're cool with it.
I'm cool with it.
So the questionnaire we're about to get into, of course, it was originated by French television personality Bernard Pivot on his show Apostrophes. Here is the questionnaire. It's 10 questions, and we'll kind of run through these, but we'll start with number one. What's your favorite word?
Man, my favorite word. The one word that I try to use as often as I can is precocious. It's a word that I remember from the song Betty Davis Eyes.
Oh, sure.
And hearing that when I was a kid, I was like, what is this word? And it kind of stuck with me until my adulthood when I was like, oh yeah, I have a dictionary. I could just look that up. And I'm like, it'd be pretty cool to be precocious. I'm down with that. So
yeah,
that's one word that I don't think I'll ever be able to get out of my vernacular.
Okay. On the opposite of that, what is your least favorite word?
Moist. I hate that word. Like most people hate that word. It's a terrible word.
Oh God. All right. What, I guess on that count, what turns you on, sir?
Whew. A really good story with a lot of detail. That's really what drives me.
Yeah. What about the opposite? What turns you off?
Drama. I hate drama. I hate when it arises because, I don't know, for whatever reason, especially when I'm at work, people feel the need to bring me their drama as if I need to hear it. So I don't like it.
As if you don't have enough in the podcast community already, right?
Exactly.
What sound or noise do you love?
One of my absolute favorite sounds, and it's because of where I've grown up all my life, is the sound of rustling leaves in the fall. That is just something that puts me in a good spot, and especially, you know, rustling leaves on the ground. It's just, it puts me in a really happy place.
That's a good one. What sound or noise do you hate?
I hate feedback, like really sharp feedback. I used to have this turntable, and I hooked it up to these speakers, these brand new speakers. This was a couple years ago, and I don't know what happened. I think the speakers were damaged while shipping, but after that, when I plugged it into the turntable, they just blew. And ever since then, every time I hear sharp static, there's this really weird smell that I can just smell, and I don't like it.
That's a good one. Okay, this is probably the most favorite one of everybody to do. What is your favorite curse word?
Fuck. That's so versatile. You can use it for... I just find myself using it in the most relaxed of ways. When I'm upset, I can do it in such a relaxed way that doesn't throw people off, but also feels therapeutic at the same time. So I think I've taken that word and made it work for me.
Yeah, there you go. It's right. It's always right at the head of the pack when it comes to curse words. It's like that's just the best. That's just the best word, I think.
Yeah.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Writing. I have always kind of had a knack for it, and ever since college, I wrote really terrible poetry in college, and I'm kind of glad I threw it out. But like, I have dipped my toes into short story writing, and if it's something that I can focus on or do more of, I know I can get better at it. But it's always interesting to try and parse these stories in your head out and put it on a page and try to make it seem good and fun and something that somebody would want to engage with.
And what profession would you not like to attempt?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
That's a tough one. Yeah.
That is a tough one. I'm not exactly sure.
All right. Well, we'll go to the last question. And this is probably the most profound. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
That it was all worth it. That everything that I have done in life was worthwhile and worth it.
That's a good answer. I think we all would want to hear that. Now, before we get out of here tonight, Rob, plug the podcast, your Twitter. Where can everybody listen to Our Strange Skies, all that jazz?
Sure. So if you want to listen to the Our Strange Skies podcast, we are available on every single platform. You can also listen to us at ourstrangeskies.com, where you can also find links to our social media profiles at the bottom of the main page. You can find all our episodes, our TeePublic store, and all sorts of good stuff on over there.
Rob, this was, I looked forward to this for a long time, and you didn't disappoint, sir. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you doing this tonight.
I appreciate you for having me on, man. This was a great conversation.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air, news, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meandmyfriendspod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle @meandmyfriendspod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Tonight, the podcast featured the original song Brainless by producer Rediman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris7 Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris7 Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris7 Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris7 Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.